It's December 7th, 1941, one day before President Franklin D. Roosevelt addresses Congress and the nation. At a submarine base overlooking Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet, stares out the window of his office at the horror unfolding below. The sight of hundreds of Japanese fighter planes attacking his fleet has shocked him to the core. They appeared out of nowhere, firing torpedoes at his battleships, dropping bombs on his aircraft carriers, and peppering the air with machine gun fire. When Kimmel first learned that the U.S. was under attack, he was at his nearby home getting ready for a round of golf. But on learning of the devastation being wrought in the harbor, he immediately put on his uniform and quickly drove to the scene. Now, from his office on the submarine base overlooking Pearl Harbor, Kimmel and a handful of generals watched the carnage unfold. Just then, there's a massive explosion. Kimmel and the generals cry out in anguish as they watch the USS Arizona go up in flames. Kimmel feels like he's living a nightmare. He is responsible for this fleet, and he has failed to protect it. He reaches for the shoulder boards of his admiral uniform and rips off the four stars that indicate his senior rank. He feels he no longer deserves them. Just at that moment, the window in front of him shatters, and a fusillade of Japanese bullets miss Kimmel by a whisker, cutting his white uniform. A young communication officer dashes over to check that the admiral hasn't been harmed. Kimmel tells him that it would have been merciful had it killed him. The surprise attack on Pearl Harbor lasts just 90 minutes, but its impact will be felt much longer than that. As of earlier this morning, America was not in a state of war with Japan or any other country in the world. But as a direct result of this act of aggression, America's standing will change. Thousands of miles away in Washington, the President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, will soon make a declaration of war before Congress. His words will not just alter the direction of the Second World War, but they will also be remembered as one of the greatest speeches in American history. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is December 8th, 1941, President Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech. It's December 7th, 1941, at the White House in Washington, D.C. It's 1:30 p.m., just hours after the attack at Pearl Harbor. At his desk, the 32nd President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or FDR as many people call him, sits in his wheelchair. He smokes a cigarette and discusses the ongoing war in Europe with his foreign policy advisor Harry Hopkins, his main liaison with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. World War II began over 2 years ago in Europe when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. Great Britain and France responded by declaring war on Germany, and before long, all of the world's major powers entered the conflict, except the United States. Prime Minister Churchill has persistently pleaded for America to join the fight against fascism, but so far, America has offered only diplomatic support. Roosevelt has publicly stated that he wants to ally with Britain and Russia against the Axis powers of Germany, Italy, and Japan. But as President FDR knows that he cannot declare war without approval from Congress. Today, the president and his advisors discuss just how obstructive Congress might prove. Suddenly, Navy Secretary Frank Knox bursts into the room, startling the president and his advisor. They can tell by looking at him that something is terribly wrong. His face has turned the color of ash. Knox tells the astonished president that the Japanese have just attacked Pearl Harbor. He tells him that 16 ships, including 5 battleships, are damaged or sunk and that thousands of people, sailors, marines, and civilians, have been killed or wounded. Roosevelt is outraged. As far as he's concerned, Japan has not made an official declaration of war, which means that every serviceman who died at Pearl Harbor has been murdered. He demands to speak to Admiral Kimmel, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet, so he can learn more about this heinous act. Elsewhere in the White House, the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, hosts a luncheon for some important dignitaries. Since her husband first won a seat in the New York State Senate back in 1911, Eleanor Roosevelt has immaculately performed the social duties of a political wife. And although she is widely admired for her diplomatic skills, she finds events like these tedious. And today, she's having a hard time concentrating on the task at hand. Through the door, she can see various White House aides scurrying about, looking panicked, even frightened. She can tell something big is happening. So she gracefully makes her excuses and glides out of the room on her way to see her husband. When she finds him, FDR is on the phone with Admiral Kimmel, surrounded by a group of advisors who look on in stony silence. Not wishing to interrupt her husband, she turns to one of the advisors and asks what's happening. He doesn't respond, instead keeps his eyes fixed on the president. Then Eleanor hears her husband ask about Japanese fighter planes and the state of the fleet in Pearl Harbor. She begins to piece the catastrophe together. After 36 years of marriage, Eleanor knows her husband better than anyone alive. They were still children when they met. And over the long years since, she has developed an expert sense for how FDR feels at any given moment. As he finishes his call and hangs up the phone, she can tell he is incensed by the surprise attack, even though his outward behavior displays, in her later words, a deadly calm. For the rest of the day, FDR conducts himself with steady efficiency. He consults with military advisors and deals with the media. Later in the afternoon, he receives a call from Winston Churchill in England. The two leaders have had a fractious relationship. When Churchill was made prime minister last year, FDR told one of his advisors that Churchill was the best man England had, even if he was drunk half of his time. FDR hopes that Churchill isn't drunk now, as he confirms what the prime minister has heard about the Japanese attack. The Englishman sounds sober and serious as he offers America his condolences. And then Churchill remarks, "Surely America must now enter the great war that's being fought in Europe and Asia. Japan is an ally of Nazi Germany, and so, as Churchill succinctly puts it, we are all in the same boat now." FDR assures Churchill that yes, this means war. America will enter the fight against the Axis powers. Tomorrow, President Roosevelt will deliver those exact sentiments. He will appear before Congress and deliver a speech that will define his presidency. He'll speak of the terrible injustice that has been inflicted on his neutral country, and then declare that America is neutral no longer. It's the evening of December 7th, 1941, at the White House. President Roosevelt sits in his wheelchair at his desk. As he holds a pen tight in his hand, he can hear a crowd of people gathered outside the White House gates singing "God Bless America." Their voices remind him of why he is writing this speech and who he is writing it for. The people of America need to hear from their leader tomorrow. He knows his words must be both decisive and considered. When he addresses Congress, his country, and the world, he will declare war upon Japan. He needs a speech worthy of such a historic moment. But so far, he's only written one line, and he's not sure if he even likes that. He leans back in his chair and reads it back to himself aloud. He begins by describing December 7th as a date which will live in world history. He crosses it out, feeling he can surely come up with something stronger. Since learning of the heinous attack on Pearl Harbor, even more shocking events have unfolded around the world. The president was informed that Japan has also invaded the British colonies of Hong Kong, Malaya, and Singapore, as well as the Philippines. These facts speak for themselves. Japan has undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific. The president sets down his pen for a moment and lights up another cigarette. As he smokes, he again considers Japan's unprovoked assault on Pearl Harbor. Finds it as bewildering as it is enraging. According to his military advisors, their plan was somehow to knock out the entire United States Pacific Fleet in one devastating blow, leaving America unable to retaliate. He exhales a puff of smoke as he considers the audacity of the surprise attack. Even more outrageous, FDR feels, is that Japan, a country that often boasts of honor in war, has not yet issued an official declaration of hostilities. And yet, considering the many thousands of miles between Japan and Hawaii, it's obvious to anyone that this was not some spontaneous action. It was planned, for weeks in advance, at the very least. Extinguishing his cigarette, the president again grabs his pen and returns to the speech. Roosevelt is confident that as a leader, he is up to the challenges that war will bring. He is in the middle of an unprecedented third term as president of the United States, and he has already steered his country through some extremely difficult times. When he first took office in 1933, America was in the grips of the Great Depression. During his inaugural address then, he assured the people that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. He promised to employ the same urgency to the crippling economic crisis that he would if we were invaded by a foreign force. Both those sentiments resonate with him as he crafts his speech now. So far in his presidency, FDR is broadly regarded as successful due to the proactive solutions he introduced to restore prosperity to Americans, a series of social programs that were collectively known as the New Deal. He also brought an end to Prohibition, a divisive ban on alcohol that had resulted in so much violence and crime throughout the previous decade. But despite these achievements, FDR knows that the speech he is currently writing will be the only one by which his legacy will be defined. Fortunately, he thinks, one of the qualities he shares with Winston Churchill is a gift for oratory. At last, Roosevelt finishes his first draft and lays down his pen. Then he goes to bed, expecting that he will probably rewrite much of it tomorrow. Today has felt like the longest day in an already long presidency. But on the morning of December 8th, the president looks back over what he has written and is generally happy. It's quite short, but he hopes its brevity will lend it a power that a longer speech might lack. But he is still stuck on that opening line. With less than an hour before he is due to make his address, FDR will make a quick but effective alteration to his speech. He will remove that part about a day that will live in world history and replace it with a phrase that he hopes will better stress the depths of America's feelings. And soon he will appear before Congress and declare that when the Japanese launched their attack on Pearl Harbor, they made yesterday a date that will live in infamy. It's December 8th, 1941, in Washington. President Franklin D. Roosevelt clears his throat before delivering his speech before Congress. He is situated behind a podium on which half a dozen microphones from all the major radio networks are positioned to catch his every word.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
The president explains that until now, America has been at peace with Japan, and that their government deliberately misled him into believing it wanted to remain that way. He then informs his listeners about the other attacks the Japanese Empire has launched throughout Asia. His speech is worded to inspire fierce patriotism and to stress that now is the time for America to defend herself.
I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us.
Then Roosevelt assures his people that despite the dramatic events of the previous day, America will be triumphant.
With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
Finally, Roosevelt concludes his speech with the part the whole world has been waiting to hear.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
33 minutes later, Congress declares war against Japan. With that, America officially enters World War II. His speech lasted just 6 minutes and 30 seconds, but attracted the largest audience in radio history. FDR achieved both an immediate and long-lasting impact with his simple and brilliantly considered piece of rhetoric which went on to become one of the most iconic speeches in history. Next on History Daily, December 9th, 1979, a commission of scientists declare that the scourge of the world, the infectious and deadly virus smallpox, has been eradicated. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Molly Bach, sound design by Misha Stanton, music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by James Benmore. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship, Pascal Hughes for Noiser.